Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
My name's Richard Moore. I am joined today by Watford fan and blogger Lionel Burney.
Oh, hello, Rich. Little introductions now.
And television's Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
Daniel, running a bit of a social media campaign, Daniel, to make English the language of bicycle racing, I notice.
What? I'm just confused. You know, this whole Itzulia thing in the Basque Country. It's a new thing, isn't it? And I think I don't think anyone used to say the Ronde van Vlaanderen unless they were from Flanders. That's not very new, isn't it?
I think, yeah, the Tour of the Basque Country has too many names, doesn't it? It's got a lot of names.
Although I have been enlightened about that, and apparently that's been a bit of a campaign on the part of the organisation over the last couple of years to rebrand it. Quite risque, obviously, at first, initially with you know, the sort of historical tensions between the Basque Country and Spain, because most people used to know the race as by the Spanish name, País Vasco, Vuelta al País Vasco. But yeah, now Itzulia.
Which means tour in Basque, is that right?
Yeah. Correct.
I mean, I think we should just go back to the days when Cycling Weekly decided what everything was called, and we'll be off to the Tour of Italy later in the spring, won't we? Mm-hmm.
Followed by the Tour of France.
The Tour of Spain. I mean, what was wrong with that? What was wrong with that? Really? I'm kidding, of course. I'm kidding. But, you know, it's like all these things, Daniel. You know, whether San Remo is one word or two, I mean, it's a minefield, isn't it?
It is. It is, napalm.
Were you both glued to the Ronde van Vlaanderen at the weekend?
I was glued, more or less from start to finish, Rich, yeah. All six and however many hours of it there were. We'll be talking about that.
We will. How many wine glasses for you, Daniel?
I would say it was a three. I've got a feeling that Napalm's going to give it a bad rap when we're going to review it later. But
well, I'd give it two, but two filled up to the brim.
Yeah,
very generous.
Of some fairly ropey supermarket Pinot.
Yeah, exactly.
We are going to discuss the Tour of Flanders, obviously, and Nicky Terpstra's win there. And we're going to look ahead to Paris-Roubaix. Maybe we'll glance across to the Basque Country, Itzulia. Must be the only Basque word without an X in it, I think, that one. We're going to be overtaken by events there, but we watched a very exciting stage one yesterday, won by Julian Alaphilippe. But just before we go to you for your news roundup, Lionel, a mention of our event in Glasgow next week. That's Wednesday the 11th of April. We're doing events in Glasgow on the 11th and Edinburgh on the 12th at the Signet Library. The Edinburgh event is, I believe, sold out, but there are still tickets available for Glasgow on the 11th. It's at the beautiful Trades Hall in the Merchant City, and tickets available there. It'll be myself, Lionel Burney, Francois Tomazo and Orla Shinoui. We'll be reading bits from our new book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, and talking about everything that's going on in the world of cycling and taking questions. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com live events to find out how to get your ticket, and indeed to get your ticket, and we hope to see as many of you there as possible. Lionel, can we get your weekly news roundup, please?
We can. I mean, you spoiled two-thirds of it there with all the...
Sorry.
Yeah, we all know Nicky Terpstra won the Tour of Flanders at the weekend, adding it to the Paris-Roubaix he won in 2014. It's been an incredible spring for Quick-Step and for Terpstra, who, of course, won the Grand Prix E3 Hauerbecker a week or so ago. He won it by marking a move by Vincenzo Nibali on the false flat after the Kreuzberg with about 27 kilometres to go. He then bridged across to the leading trio, Sebastian Langeveld, Dylan van Baarle and Mads Pedersen, went straight past them more or less on the final ascent of the Alpe d'Huez and rode solo to the finish. A really impressive victory. Quick-Step really never, well, it was always in their grasp, and they never tightened their grip on the race. And Terpstra, an impressive solo victory. Equally impressive.
They never tightened their grip on the race. You mean never loosened?
They never loosened
their
grip. Sorry. Yeah. They, that's exactly what I meant. Yeah.
Yes.
They never loosened their grip. Never loosen their grip. Oh dear. Yeah, anyway, Mads Pedersen was probably the surprise of the race. A 22-year-old Dane riding for Trek Segafredo, the Danish national champion, of course, hung on for a brilliant second place, and last year's winner Philippe Gilbert of Quickstep was third to make it two Quickstep riders on the podium. Peter Sagan, the world champion, had tried to set off in pursuit after the Paterberg, but got nowhere really. And the powerful chase group, which had almost all of the favourites in it, Valgren, Greg Van Avermaet, Sagan, of course, Jasper Stuyven, Thijs Benoot, Wout van Aert, Oliver Nuss and Sepp van Mark, they really sort of sat and watched and waited and let Terpstra get away from them. So we'll talk about all the implications of that later on in the episode, or in the first part of the episode. It completed a fantastic week for Quickstep because Yves Lampaert had won the Dwars door Vlaanderen for the second successive year on the Wednesday before the Tour of Flanders. Mike Tournissen of Sunweb pitched Sepp van Mark in the sprint for second place there. And as Richard mentioned, in the Basque country at Itzulia, Julian Alaphilippe got off to a flyer there for Quickstep, winning the opening stage. Another bit of news from the Tour of Flanders, or the other thing that was sparking a bit of controversy, was the disqualification of Team Sky's Luke Rowe for riding on the cycle path and ducking between the spectators as the race approached the Isle de Quaremont for the second time. We'll talk about that a little bit later on as well, whether that was the right decision or wrong. A few other race results elsewhere. Alejandro Valverde, who'd been really impressive at Dwars door Vlaanderen, finishing 11th in that race. A lot of people were hoping that he might stay on and do the Tour of Flanders and see how he got on there. I suspect he probably would have done pretty well because he's bang in form. He won the Grand Prix Miguel Indurain just a few days before the start of the Tour of the Basque Country. Meanwhile, over in France, Sylvain Dillier of AG2R won the Route Adelie. There was the Women's World Tour Tour of Flanders as well. Anna van der Breggen won that. That's her second World Tour Classic win of the season. She won Strade Bianche last month. Van der Breggen made it at Bolsdolmen 1-2, and an all-Dutch podium with Amy Peters and Annemiek van Vleuten of Mitchelton Scott taking second and third. Another very impressive solo move. Had it on the laptop watching the final stages, but it wasn't until somebody pointed out on Twitter, but she basically went clear at more or less the same point that the Nibali Terpstra move happened, sort of after the Kruisberg and before the Isle de Quaremont. But yeah, another impressive victory.
I think a mention of Van Vleuten's dislocated shoulder as well. She dislocated her shoulder and popped it back in. There was a horrific crash in that race. So to finish third after that, definitely worthy of mention.
Talking of controversy and crashes, chaps, did you notice the beef between the Groupama FDJ riders and Tony Martin? Tony Martin, well, he was accused by Antoine Duchesne of FDJ of basically shunting him, shoving him off the road. I'm not sure where that was exactly, but Duchesne ended up in a ditch, and Martin was. Pretty, he was obscured on the video, on the TV coverage, so it was difficult to tell exactly, you know, how deliberate it was, but it didn't look too good. And then Jacopo Guarnieri weighed in and aimed some not very flattering comments in Tony Martin's directions, and then Davide Cimolai did the same.
Stick to time trialing, I think they said. That was the gist of it, wasn't it?
Oh dear. Well, just to wrap up the news, we can't really offer much clarification on this, but the Chris Froome latest French newspaper Le Monde has reported that the Chris Froome salbutamol case has been referred to the UCI's independent anti-doping tribunal. The UCI has not confirmed this. Chris Froome initially tweeted that it was fake news, but that tweet has since been deleted, so the UCI are not commenting and have not issued any kind of statement. So at the moment, we can either take Le Monde's word for it or not, I guess. We'll have to see how that shakes out.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our main sponsor, Rafa, of course. And we should tell you that the Rafa Prestige Series has launched. Take on an unsupported and unmarshaled adventure across stunning terrain. Gather your team and sign up to ride together on challenging courses across the world. Find new roads and forge new friendships at the Rafa Prestige Series. The series offers a unique challenge to riders across the globe, from the rocky valleys of the Ozark Plateau in the US to the ancient forests of Obihiro in Japan. Open to all with a number of women-only rides. Go to the Rafa website, rafa.cc/feature/Rafa-prestige. Lionel, you're very down on the race. Is that coloured by general antipathy towards Nicky Terpstra, perhaps?
I'm not down on the race. I mean, a 6 out of 10 Tour of Flanders is just below average for the Tour of Flanders.
It's better than a 5 out of 10.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that a number of things on Sunday just left me a little bit cold. One was how obvious it all was. As soon as Terpstra bridged across to Vincenzo Nibali, I just thought, well, that is it done. And in fact, Daniel sent me a text saying that's it, and I thought, well, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking as soon as Nibali couldn't hold that wheel and Terpstra was away, and then seeing how he blasted past the three up the road, it was done. I wanted a bit more action going on behind. Everyone just allowed it to happen, and that's fine. That's how these races are. They kind of hinge on these moments that no one, I mean, in hindsight, it's really easy just to say, well, that was the moment. Why didn't they react? What, you know, a quick step going up the road, 27K from the finish, surely somebody has to go. But of course, quick step had the numbers and the other teams didn't. And so,
well, that's what we said, isn't it, before? That's what we said last week. I mean, the numerical advantage was always going to be a massive factor, but you know, I think they deserve massive credit for that, as we said last week about, well, they've taken a gamble. They've stacked their roster towards the classics. I mean, I looked at their roster again over the weekend and I thought, well, you know, it's a good job these first three months of the season have gone the way they have, because they're going to be spread really thinly when it comes to the stage races. You know, they got rid of De La Cruz, they got rid of Brambilla, and they got rid of Dan Martin. So I think they might struggle, and there are going to be a lot of stage races where they're not going to be a factor. But they've gone down this road, and, you know, when I hear Sagan talking, well, kind of sort of striking the same notes that he has done several times over the last few years, sort of complaining, really, that people don't work with him, well, I mean, he was always going to find himself in that situation, in the sense that he becomes his own worst enemy when there is a dangerous rider off the front, because people always then look to him and say, well, it's up to you. And he kind of made the decision a couple of years ago to join Bora and to demand a huge salary, which has basically eaten up the budget of that team, and kind of isolated himself by virtue of that. He was always going to be, he's always going to be the sort of kingpin who sucks up all of a team's resources. He could have gone to Quickstep and been one of three or four.
Well, there was talk of him going to Quickstep,
yeah,
wasn't
there? Yeah, they balked, and they absolutely balked at his asking price. You know, I think he's really paid the penalty for that.
It kind of underlines that cycling is a team sport, doesn't it? There's this sort of natural check on perhaps individuals commanding huge, huge salaries, because we can see with Sagan that is the case. But did he make an error as well, or did the team make an error? Because I watched again the sort of final hour of the race, and there's a moment where it's a bit anarchic. Astana are kind of taking a little bit of control, but there's a moment where there are these four quick step riders lurking in this 30-man group with about an hour to go, when Daniel Oss just goes to the front and takes control. Steve Barr had sort of drifted off the front a bit at one point then as well, but Daniel Oss, and he noticeably he didn't actually speak to Sagan on his way up to the front of that group. He just went to the front, so he'd obviously been told to do so by the team, and he sat in the front for about 8 kilometers, and that was him done after that. And pretty much as soon as he was done, that's when Nibali went and Terpstra went after him. But was that a mistake by Sagan to use up Oss when he did?
He didn't have enough guys, did he? I mean,
yeah, in hindsight, obviously, yes. But I mean, as Daniel says, I mean, it wasn't like there was anyone else. I mean, you know, somebody had to do something at that point. And like you say, you know, if everyone's looking at Quickstep, but they're, you know, well, they had the numbers, so they almost could absolve themselves of the responsibility. It really was down to Oss, really. I mean,
yeah, but they have the numbers, but they, you know, there are enough other guys there. Tish Benoit, Luke Feistrong, Greg Van Avermaet, you know, there were enough other guys there to mark any.
But they're not going to do. They're not going to do that grunt work at that point in the race, are
no,
they?
Of
they're,
course not.
They're,
of course
they're the,
not.
So they're the. You know, they're just sitting there. So really, it was probably falling into the very obvious trap, Os doing all that work. But then, you know, who knows? I mean, it's only now in hindsight you look and think, well, the way that that front three, Pedersen rode fantastically to get his second place. But, you know, as it kind of all boiled down to that front three of Langefeld, Van Baarle and Pedersen, you know, you couldn't have imagined that Van Baarle and Langefeld would crumble quite as much as they, or quite as quickly as they did when Terpstra caught them. I thought they were riding more strongly than that. So at the time, it was probably the right thing to do, but the obvious mistake in hindsight for Bora and Os to do that work then. But like you say, you know, it's not until the end of the race that it kind of all shakes out. It's really easy to say afterwards, but at the time, when the gap's still, you know, not really coming down, and you know, there's riders up the road that might be dangerous or might not be, you know, everyone's still worried about a surprise or a shock. I mean, particularly Langefeld, not somebody that you want to be just drifting 45 seconds off the front, you know, not under control, is he?
What made it disappointing is too strong a word then. What would have been a more exciting race for you, Lionel? A group coming to the finish or what?
I think we didn't see you know, Van Marke, Benoot, Van Avermaet. We didn't really, I mean, Van Avermaet had, there was a period where he looked incredibly strong, looked really good, but we didn't see them kind of going toe to toe at any point really in the race. It was one where it was kind of on the back burner and never really got onto the front burner. And you know, I'm kind of feel a little bit sensitive about being accused of being negative about the Tour of Flanders, but I do think that expectations are very high of these races, you know, rightly so. And I think it's important when we see one that isn't an absolute classic that we say it's not an absolute classic, rather than, you know, I'm saying, wow, you know, that was absolutely unbelievable stuff we watched, because I didn't feel it was absolutely unbelievable stuff we watched. It was a really impressive ride by Nicky Terpstra, who's in great form, seized his opportunity every bit, more impressive than his GPE3 win, you know, a week or so before, taking nothing away from Quickstep. But it's, for me, when I kind of, you know, any sport I watch, I kind of like to see this kind of the unusual story happen. You know, I'm not somebody who watches a football match hoping that, you know, we just see a majestic display from Barcelona, Manchester City, or, you know, whoever happens to be the dominant force. I like to see a bit of competition. I like to see the apple cart upset a little bit. And I didn't sense, you know, the apples weren't even wobbling in the cart, were they? It was basically the cart was wheeled over the cobbles by Quickstep to the finish line, and they didn't drop any of them on the way. Fair play, really impressive, but just not for me. You know, that's not what gets me on the edge of my seat. And it's my own fault for watching all 6 hours of it. You know, needn't have done that. But the start wasn't very good either. It was fast and hard, no doubt. But a hard race isn't necessarily a really exciting race all the time. Sometimes, you know, the difficulty of it makes it.
I go back to that moment, Lionel, when Os took up the chase of the three up the road. You know, there are three quite dangerous riders, kind of outsiders up the road, and there are no Quickstep riders among them. Surely the onus at that point is on Quickstep to either chase or bridge across. And I think that was the moment when the other riders, all of them, could have let Quickstep do that, sort of played a game of bluff where they were appeared to be content for these three riders to just ride away with it, because Quickstep are the team there that are missing out. And I'm afraid, I think Bora made it very, very easy for them, and to a less extent Astana and BMC.
But Rich, conversely, I'm sure what they were thinking at that point, Bora, was that they were sitting ducks in that point, at that point, in the sense that there were three, and possibly Lampert was still there as well, there were maybe four Quickstep riders. They needed to keep the pace high at that point to ward off the inevitable Quickstep attacks. As it was, Os didn't manage to do that, and that's where Sagan is really lacking at the moment, because, you know, he has two options in that scenario. He can put guys on the front and try and keep the pace as fast as possible to stop the Gilberts, the Terpstras going off the front, or he can, in the best case scenario, have a guy down the road in that three with Langefeld and Pedersen, and who's the other rider? But he didn't.
Van Baarle.
But he didn't have either, and he really was a lame duck at that point. And, you know, I think as regards the sort of apple cart being upset and, you know, how exciting it was, I mean, I think that again, the excitement of this Tour of Flanders, and not to sort of broaden out too much, but came when the pieces of the fruit salad were assembled in the winter. The Tour of Flanders was won at the end of last year when Quickstep decided to keep all of those riders, the Terpstras and the Stibars, and they got rid of Dan Martin and Bramby Lund.
Terpstras, your golden delicious, isn't he?
I'm not having a fruit salad analogy. There was no fruit salad about it. It was literally just apples in a cart for me, and that's fine.
Yes, Terpstra, by that I mean he leaves a little bit of a sour taste for we don't really know why. Why do people not love Nicky Terpstra?
Well, he's a big cooking apple. He's a big cooking apple, isn't he? So sour until baked in the oven and then deliciously sweet. I mean, this is nonsense.
I think a lot of this stems, Rich, from kind of rooted in reality. But there was a piece in L'Equipe a few years ago which went into quite a lot of detail about how unpopular Terpstra was in the peloton. I looked that piece up this morning, and some good quotes from Terpstra. He said, "I've realised that I've got a lot more enemies than friends in this sport, but I don't need any friends." Patrick Lefebvre said, "My respect for the rider is bigger than whatever questions I might have about his personality," which doesn't sound like a ringing endorsement. And Tom Boonen said that when Terpstra was at Milram, he hated him more than anyone else in the peloton. But I think the consensus has always been that he's a great guy to have on your team, but not particularly fun to ride against. I remember Mark Cavendish saying that early in his career, Terpstra's career, when he was at Milram, he was a bit of a crash magnet, a bit reckless in the peloton. But I understand that, you know, this has been brought up again in press conferences over the last two or three weeks to Terpstra, you know, where is he a difficult character? Does he rub people up the wrong way? I think there was one of our colleagues asked him in the press conference after E3, and he replied, "Well, you obviously don't know anything about cycling." So he was pretty salty.
Oof,
he's the water carrier, isn't he, in that team? And for just because of the way things have panned out, you know, he's taken two massive opportunities in the last week or so, and won two big races that to add to Paris-Roubaix, which was, you know, by no means, well, it wasn't a fluky win, that was it, when he won Paris-Roubaix, but it was a sort of similar circumstances in the sense that, you know, the lesser watched man. I mean, no excuse not to watch him this time, surely, after the way he rode at Harelbeke. I made the point to you, Daniel, and when we were sort of texting while watching on Sunday, as soon as Terpstra went, he was the one who seized the moment, and Mark Nibali, you know, Vincenzo Nibali, everyone knows, you know, his stature in the world of cycling, but, you know, this was his Tour of Flanders debut. Probably people wouldn't have thought, well, that's definitely a sort of A-plus move to Mark. They just let him drift off the front, and then Terpstra was the one who thought, well, that might be quite handy to go with him. And I thought the moment that he proved too fast for Nibali on that sort of false flat after the Kreuzberg, I mean, that for me, that was the moment the race was done, and fair play to Terpstra.
He blew him away, didn't he?
Blew him away, totally.
There were some echoes of Nibali's attack behind, was it Nylands, the Latvian rider at Milan San Remo. But in both cases, I think the fact that it was a seemingly innocuous rider out the front maybe lulled the group into a bit of a false sense of security, because Nibali, it was a big surprise that he was there with 30 kilometres to go in the Tour of Flanders. No one, I don't think, in the main group really thought that he was a genuine threat at that point. And consequently, maybe they didn't take Terpstra's attack seriously enough. Another thing I noticed about Terpstra was that he was a long way back, and this is often the way he rides, but the first time at the Quaremont, he was sort of in 60th, 70th position. I assumed that he was on a bad day, you know, bearing in mind that 12 months ago, the sort of decisive move of the race had gone on the Mur with about 90 kilometres to go. I thought it was very risky to be so far back so late in the race, but obviously not.
I must just correct myself. I meant Granny Smith, not Golden Delicious. Golden Delicious apples are quite sweet. That's more of a Julien Alaphilippe. I think Granny Smith has that sharp taste. That's more Nicky Terpstra. But it was interesting. I think Ed Pickering mentioned last week that that a lot of the decisive attacks at Tour of Flanders don't come on the climbs themselves, but, you know, over the top on the the false flat that follows, and that's what happened on Sunday. You know, Greg Van Avermaet, Sepp Van Marck were both very good at the kind of spectacular attack on the cobbles, really stringing things out, but actually not making any difference and not gaining any kind of advantage. Spectacular, great to watch, but the attacks that often stick are the ones that come, you know, once the climb is over and people are gathering themselves, and you know, and there's those roads are tough there, aren't they? The climb sort of carries on.
But I think that's possibly, you know, my kind of sense of slight deflation watching the race unfold. It is my own fault. You know, I get too excited about it, thinking that, you know, we're going to see so many riders on form, so many different ways for each of them to try and win. You know, are we going to see a group of, you know, maybe six of the absolute top hitters all coming to the bottom of the final climb up the Paterberg together, and then we'll see how they shake it out. I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's a fantasy scenario, and it so rarely happens. You know, that's why it remains a fantasy scenario. It happens so rarely. What we actually see is we see these kind of ghost-like moves at places where we would perhaps not expect them. But you know, really, history tells us that that's exactly what we should expect. The false flats are always the dangerous parts, because that's where people have made an effort on the climbs. Very often the spectacular Hollywood type moves are not the ones that get the job done, and so we saw on Sunday. And I'm not criticizing anyone for that. I'm just saying that as a race, as televisual entertainment, it didn't really justify the hype on this occasion. But then again, I'm used to being there as well a lot of years, and so I think an awful lot of the brilliance and beauty and charm of the Tour of Flanders is to be found out on the roads of Flanders. You know, the sights and sounds and smells of it, rather than just watching it on in a rather two-dimensional way.
Also, to bear that out, Lionel, I would strongly recommend that no one ever watches the Tour of Flanders at the same time as watching Arsenal struggle to beat Stoke City, because I was trying to watch them both simultaneously, and I kept thinking, I was watching the Arsenal game and thinking, this is dire, and then I'd go back to watching Flanders and find myself thinking, this is dire as well, and then I actually realised, I did a sort of double take and realised, no, I was, you know, my mind was sort of locked into, yeah.
A man who's tired of the Tour of Flanders is tired of life, maybe. But I'm not tired of the Tour of Flanders at all. I just think it's important that when we, you know, we say what we see, rather than just kind of get the fluffy Lion of Flanders toys out and wave the flags and pom-poms.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
The voice of Seb Piquet reminds us to tell you that this week's episode is being sponsored by The Economist. We welcome back the 170-year-old magazine as a cycling podcast sponsor, and we've got a listener offer that we'll tell you about in a moment. But first, Lionel, you had a look at economist.com. Anything catch your eye?
Yeah, The Economist is about more than just economics and finance. It also covers current affairs and politics, and the story that leapt out at me before the weekend was the Palestinian protest marches, which erupted into violence with the Israeli forces killing over a dozen Palestinians in Gaza. And the reason that caught my eye was because the Giro d'Italia is starting there in a little under a month's time. And what I appreciated about The Economist coverage was that it was not sensational, it was purely factual and therefore trustworthy. I got to the end with a clear sense of, you know, what had actually happened.
Well, I read the magazine itself, and especially the special 10-page report on AI, artificial intelligence, mainly to see if there were any threats to us, Lionel, as journalists, or indeed as podcast hosts. Will we be replaced by robots?
Welcome to the cycling podcast. Is that how it's going to work?
No, but there are threats. Bloomberg is already using AI to scan companies' earnings releases and automatically generate news articles. So journalists, they're being replaced by machines. But it could help us too, because there is AI that can listen in to calls and conversations and jump in if you forget to mention something or make a mistake. Very useful for your news roundup, I thought.
Well, you two already do that.
And there's nothing artificial about us, is there?
Nothing artificial about your intelligence, certainly.
No, absolutely. Well, The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. Get your free copy now. Go to economist.com/cycling and enter your details for a free copy delivered direct to your door if you live in the UK. That's economist.com/cycling. So, chaps, just picking up any more loose threads from the Tour of Flanders, quite a few talking points from Mads Pedersen. You know, when Nicky Terpstra blasted past those three leading riders, you wondered if he might have just, you know, stayed with them for a...
Well, I thought he'd made a mistake, Rich. I thought exactly that. I thought that he should have squeezed the last drops of energy out of them and then gone on. But, yeah, they do say that when you do catch a group, the smartest thing to do is usually to counterattack straight away.
I think it was the right decision because Pedersen, you know, might have been a difficult guy to drop because he kept that gap pretty constant, and he seemed to get a second wind. And at one point, I even thought he might catch Terpstra. He was incredibly strong.
Yeah, he's a guy who showed a bit of pedigree on the cobbles as an under 23. Won the under 23 Gent Wevelgem, obviously a big talent. Won Tour of Denmark last year. Just 22 years old, I think, was the youngest guy to get on the podium of the Tour of Flanders since Freddie Martins in the 70s. I was doing some research about him earlier. Typed Mads Pedersen into Google. One of the first links that came up was Danish tomato farmer aims to become Europe's biggest producer of medicinal cannabis. But apparently it's a different Mads Pedersen.
God, he's multi-talented. But the interesting thing is there, and I noticed Trek Segafredo have tied him up on a new longer term contract. But Freddie Martins, who you mentioned, did finish on the podium aged 21 and something, I think, or 22, but he never won the Tour of Flanders, of course. So, you know, just because he's put in this extraordinary performance doesn't mean he's going to go on and win it one day.
No, and the fact that they've signed him up or they've tied him to a longer contract so early is indicative of a bit of a trend we've seen over the last couple of years. More and more teams doing their negotiating very early in the season, which I suppose is symptomatic of greater stability in the sport, which is better. You know, we've long maligned the lack of stability and the fact that teams can't really plan 2, 3, 4 years ahead. But Trek Segafredo obviously feel that they're... their future is pretty secure in order to do that.
Yeah, very impressive by Pedersen. What about the other the controversial talking point, the disqualification of Luke Rowe for basically going on the bike path and weaving back between the spectators to get back into the bunch just as they were making that right-hand turn. He was disqualified from the race and pulled out as soon as he'd been informed that he was disqualified, and then said afterwards that basically there's been a flick across the road which had forced everyone to the right, and he was left with the choice of either crashing or staying upright and going behind the spectators, who had encroached a bit and narrowed down the available space for the riders. It's one of these situations, isn't it? The grey area. The riders aren't supposed to take the cycle path. They're not supposed to hop up onto pavements. They're not supposed to hop across roundabouts or any other sort of street furniture. But we see it all the time in all races. And it's one of those ones where presumably they saw it and thought that was crossing the line, a move that was perhaps endangering the spectators. Maybe that was the reason. I don't know what you think.
We see it all the time, Napalm, but usually the riders do it to try and gain an advantage. In this case, that was definitely not what Rowe was trying to do. In fact, it put him in a pretty bad position because the peloton was just going into a bottleneck. And as you say, I mean, the rules are pretty clear, but I also think the organisers need to keep their part of the bargain, i.e. they need to keep the crowd where they should be, on the road or off the road, as the case may be. So I thought it was pretty harsh.
Yeah, and it's not applied consistently, is it? Which makes it confusing for everybody. It's difficult as well when the cycle path is just a continuation of the road. You know, it's just a line on the road. I used to ride in amateur races in the UK where you weren't allowed to cross the white line in the middle. It was impossible not to if you were on that side of the bunch and something happened that literally forced you over the line. In that case, if you're going to have the cycle lanes as non-entry points, put up some tape or something. I just don't think it's practical to expect riders not to, you know, you're going to have riders on that side of the bunch, and if something happens to force them onto the cycle path, what are they supposed to do, actually? And later on in the race, we saw Peter Sagan jump onto a pavement, I think, to cut a corner, and he wasn't disqualified. So the rule isn't consistent, but I also think the riders, it's extremely difficult for them to not drift onto a cycle path when that cycle path is just a continuation of the road.
Well, especially if what Luke Rowe says is true, and we have no real reason to doubt him. I mean, these kind of movements where everyone moves from one side of the road to the other, I mean, there's absolutely nothing you can do to stop that. I mean, that's how the peloton moves. And so, you know, they will go as far as they possibly can. And of course, you know, we only saw a clip of it, so we don't, you know, we don't know the circumstances that led up to that move that led to Luke Rowe going right of the spectators rather than left. But it looked to me, just from the aerial shot, that he's being genuine when he said he'd had no choice. And you know, he wasn't taking liberties with the spectators' safety either. You know, he slowed down quite considerably and cut back in, you know, where he could, and I think the spectators there have caused the issue by encroaching onto the cycle path area. And unless there's a raised curb separating the road from the cycle path, as there often is, you know, sometimes the cycle paths in that area of or all across Flanders, sometimes they're separated from the road on a raised bit. They're more pavement than they are road. But in this case, it certainly looked to be more road than pavement. And so, you know, it literally is a case of where do you draw the line. And so it was a harsh decision, and one that will lead to sort of feelings of resentment if it's applied inconsistently. I mean, the commissaires, you know, there aren't that many of them. They can't have eyes on everything. They're only going to take action on things that they see with their own eyes. Although, you know, there is recourse to use television evidence, I gather, now. So, you know, they could have made a retrospective decision, but that decision was made out on the road. No comeback for it, and game over for Rowe. Pretty unfortunate for him, considering what he went through last year. Broke his leg on his brother's stag do.
I think he'll be pretty pleased. A boating accident. I think he jumped into a river.
Wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think he'll be pretty pleased though overall, because it was deep into the race. He was still there, and you know, he's got himself back to match fitness, as it were, pretty quickly.
And chaps, I mean, in some mitigation, I think there is, well, there's a sort of sensitization around this issue when it comes to the Tour of Flanders, because there was that awful incident in 2014 where Van Someren hit a female spectator and she was paralysed. So, you know, that's probably one reason why the commissaires are looking more keenly at this kind of thing than in other races. I mean, that said, just to return to the point about gaining an advantage, it was only a few weeks ago that Peter Sagan won a stage of Tirreno, having bunny hopped onto a curb in the last 2 kilometres, and you know, we all raved about, you know, what fantastic ingenuity he'd shown. So yeah, a tricky one. And just on Sky, chaps, interesting that they've still, well, they still haven't really cracked the Tour of Flanders, have they? Sagan was pretty critical about their tactics, you know, what they tried to do with Van Baarle. Kwiatkowski wasn't really a factor.
Yeah, I mean, Gianni Moscon as well. I mean, on paper they had a very strong team, but didn't deliver. Somebody who did was Wout van Aert, ninth in Tour of Flanders, and we've seen him obviously riding strongly on the cobbles, having done a cyclocross season, but to finish in the top 10 and to be still so strong towards the end of a race of that length, you know, 6 hours, 20 minutes, 260 kilometres. A young guy, that was probably his most impressive ride on the road yet, wasn't it?
Yeah, especially at the end of, well, he's effectively ridden one season already. He's ridden the cyclocross season. So to have such a fine classic season, it's been very impressive. Would also to pick out Nibali's performance.
Well, before we talk about Nibali, I mean, Van Aert, I mean, he is going to be the hottest property in when it comes to signing classics riders, isn't he? I mean, I gather he's got a contract until the end of next season with his current team, but whether or not, you know, whether or not somebody would manage to prize him away from Verandas Willems Crelan, which is his current team, a small Belgian team, it remains to be seen. But it pretty much, there won't be a sports director in the World Tour who wouldn't be interested in signing him, I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah, and just to go back to Nibali, you know, Van Aert's come in from cyclocross and shown, you know, that
that riders from that particular discipline can excel in the Tour of Flanders. Well, Nibali is coming from stage racing and known as a stage race specialist, and like Valverde in Dwars d'Or of London, really, I think, impressed everyone on Sunday. You know, we talk so much about the sort of savoir faire and the experience and the knowledge you need and the years of studying the route and having experience on those roads in order to be able to do well in the Tour of Flanders. And he came in and just, as he does, took it all in his stride and was very nonchalant and was really right up there in the thick of things until the last time at the Quaremont, so with about 20 kilometres to go.
Yeah, the thing that, I mean, I've slightly raised my eyebrow at your kind of obsession about the weight of Tour Flanders winners, Daniel, asking whether very slight riders could be a factor, but actually that was a factor, because where you need, you know, where the climbers are going to be the most vulnerable is on those false flats, where it becomes all about, it's not about climbing, it's not flat where you can kind of hide in the wheels. That is where the strongest, beefiest riders can make their advantage told. And so while I was kind of surprised at how easily Terpstra dropped Nibali on that kind of false-ish flat, it's still fairly uphilly at that stage. I mean, it kind of all adds up, really. That was a kind of an area for the strong men to really press home the advantage, whereas on the climbs, of course, you know, he's not going to have any real trouble at all when it's steep and short and punchy.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast, and a reminder that you, the listener, can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com if you enter the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. I'm meeting their experts this week to put some of your questions to them. We'll probably do that later in the year as well, but over the next few weeks and months, we'll hear some of the responses to some of your very good questions. We've had some really interesting ones, so listen out for that. And thank you once again to Science and Sport. Looking ahead to Paris-Roubaix, chaps, we're going to hear in a moment or two from William Fotheringham, who's just written a book looking back, well, looking at Paris-Roubaix, but looking at the film A Sunday in Hell, which was made about Paris-Roubaix back in the 1970s. Quite an unusual way to approach the race and a topic for a book, but we'll hear from William about how that came about. We were talking about Tour of Flanders, of course, earlier on, and interesting to think about Daniel Oss and me questioning his role on Sunday, because last year, when he was riding for BMC, he perhaps was the guy that did more than anybody to win the race for Greg Van Avermaet. He was up the road most of the day and was a really useful ally for him towards the end of the race as well. And now he's joined Bora, and he's a teammate of Peter Sagan, and it's a race that perhaps suits him a little bit better. So maybe, having written off Peter Sagan, maybe Sunday will be Peter Sagan's day. Although, Daniel, I don't think you've never been confident that Sagan would ever win Paris-Roubaix, have you?
No, I don't really think he's that well suited to it. I mean, his record bears that out. He had a sixth in his first attempt, then a 23rd, an 11th, and a 38th last year. Even the time when he finished sixth, it was a fairly innocuous edition of Paris-Roubaix, in the sense that about 25 riders finished within just over a minute of the winner. So, the weather, the forecast at the moment is for dry and sunny weather, which I would suggest might suit him well, in the sense that when the weather is like that, we tend to see a lot of the sort of non-Paris-Roubaix specialists coming to the fore. But I remember getting into an argument with someone on Twitter about this a year or two ago, about the fact that Sagan's very atypical for a Paris-Roubaix rider, just in his riding position. He's very much on top of the bike. He's not very stretched out. I mean, if you look at Terpstra at the weekend, that is someone who, to me, is the quintessential Paris-Roubaix rider. Rides a lot in the drops, and is very sort of flat-backed. And you do hear people talk about Paris-Roubaix as a very long time trial, or certainly the cobbled sections, the 50-odd kilometres or however many kilometres it is of cobbles, they are effectively time trials, and that is not necessarily Sagan's strength.
You say it's a long time trial, Daniel, so Tony Martin then?
Well, I've always thought that he would have a good chance in Paris-Roubaix. I mean, he's turned his attention to the Col Classics a bit late in his career, only in the last couple of years, and he always looks and looked again at the Tour of Flanders as though he doesn't really know what he's doing yet. He doesn't really know how to ride these races, where to be. I've never really seen him ride one of these races and thought he's really kind of had a sense of what's going to happen and been in the right place at the right time. But he certainly got the power and has in the past looked very, very good in isolated phases of certain, well, Paris-Roubaix.
But it's going to come down to Quick-Step against the rest again, isn't it? I suspect. I mean, they've got an embarrassment of riches for this as well, haven't they? I mean, Terpstra, of course, you say the quintessential Paris-Roubaix winner or rider. He is a former winner. Stibar's been on the podium at least a couple of times, I think. You know, they're going to have strength in numbers again, which is, well, if you're looking for a team to win the race, that is, you know, that often bears out in Paris-Roubaix because it isn't as controllable. And if you can get one of your B or even C riders up the road in one of the moves that you think, well, that's not going to go to the finish, suddenly it becomes, you know, it can become really important. You just never know how it's going to pan out. And just looking at their, you know, their roster, I mean, it is remarkable, isn't it? It's going to be Gilbert, Yves Lampaert, Seneschal, Florian Seneschal. He's your...
Well, who I traditionally, at this point of the year, I always tip him to win Paris-Roubaix. Perversely, this is probably the only time in history this has ever happened. I think his chances have diminished since he left, well, by virtue of leaving Cofidis. I don't think that's ever happened that a rider has become less likely to win a race when they've left Cofidis.
Well, he's going to be too far down the pecking order, but he could be the sort of rider that would go in some kind of move a long way out and suddenly becomes a factor that we perhaps hadn't anticipated early on.
Just talking about the issue of weight, Napalm. I mean, Gilbert is kind of the one who has really talked up his own chances in Paris-Roubaix, not got a lot of experience in Paris-Roubaix, but there's something that jars with me when I think about riders of his physique and Paris-Roubaix. I mean, he's one of the lighter classics riders, about 69, 70 kilos. And I mean, riders like that have won in the past and they can go well over the cobbles. But as much as Terpstra looks to me like the prototype of a Paris-Roubaix rider, Gilbert doesn't quite fit that template in my way of thinking.
Another one who does is surely Sepp van Marck. And his luck has got to change at some point. I mean, like you, I watched pretty much all of the Tour of Flanders, and when he crashes, you know, right at the start of the race and has quite a hard chase to get back on with Alberto Bettiol, you know, you think then, well, that effort's going to tell at the end, and he was still strong. I mean, he's still one of the strongest riders in the race, but he made a lot of big efforts early in the race that would have cost him at the end. He's obviously in great form. With a bit of luck, with a following wind, as it were, he could finally perhaps get the result that he threatens to produce. But a couple of riders who did very well last year at Roubaix, Jasper Stuyven and Gianni Moscon, you know, they were the young riders who really showed themselves as potentially future winners last year. Both seem to be going okay. I mean, Stuyven seems to be going very well. So perhaps Sunday it'll be one for them. Shall we do the opposite of speculation and look back at the 1976 Paris-Roubaix, shall we? Well, okay, I met William Fotheringham. His book, Sunday in Hell, it takes a look at that 1976 Paris-Roubaix through the lens of Jorgen Leth. Here is William Fotheringham. So you've written a book about a film about a race. Quite unusual. Where did the inspiration come from for that?
Well, the inspiration for it came from a film show I did in Bristol, which was a screening of Sunday in Hell about 5 or 6 years ago. And it was quite rare. It's still quite rare to see Sunday in Hell on the big screen. It was very rare at the time. And these guys got Jorgen Leth over to talk to them. So I compared the discussion afterwards. And what became very obvious was that Jorgen was, you know, there's a good story around Jorgen. There was a good story around the film. There was an awful lot going on. There's an incredible amount going on in that film that we didn't know about. So I pitched the idea to Yellow Jersey, and they kind of, well, they were okay with it, really.
So the race stuff, we're speaking on the eve of this year's Paris-Roubaix. I mean, you must have studied that 1976 race many times.
Yes.
How has the race, we think of Paris-Roubaix as a race that hasn't really changed over a century. Has it changed much since 76?
Well, obviously all the stuff around the race has changed. All the stuff you see, the the infrastructure, the cars, the starts and finishes, you know, the what you call the infrastructure, the barriers, the branding, all that has changed immensely. But the thing that most people won't be aware that has changed is, or people might not think has changed, is the route. And in fact, once you get to the cobbles, the route changes massively. You know, the way into the cobbles in 1976 was very, very different because they went up this famous hill at Neuvilly, which joins into what are now the first sections of cobbles. And as I worked it out, I think there are four, sort of maybe five, six sections of cobbles from the original route in 1976 that are still used today. I mean, the fundamentals obviously haven't changed. So you still, you know, it started in Chantilly, okay, but you know, now it starts in Compiègne. But it went through Compiègne and it used substantially the same roads from Compiègne up the cobbles as are used today. Obviously, the finish is still in the velodrome. That hasn't changed. But like I say, the cobbles, the only one that's really easy to recognise is what we call Pont Gibus, the disused railway bridge that comes just after what, in the section after the Wallace-Orenburg Forest. That's very, very easy to spot in the film. It's very, very easy to spot now. There are a couple of others, the new one at Fontaine au Tertre, where they're running at the, you know, early on, where I think it's number 26, where they're running it the wrong way around. It took me months, ages to work out precisely, you know, how that ties into the film, but eventually I did. So like I say, it's really surprising the way the routes has changed as far as the cobbles go. Obviously that's because, you know, things have been built on the cobbles like railway lines and so on, and they've tarmacked some sections, and then finally Thierry Gouvenou recently has tweaked the route quite a lot to try and, you know, make it tighter and more attractive for television.
What, back then, 76, was there the same mythology around Paris-Roubaix? I mean, now we know all about how the cobbles are preserved and you know, the it's one of the biggest races on the calendar, obviously, but was there that same sense at the time that Paris-Roubaix was a race that was going to endure, or was it under threat as it was a little bit later on?
No, it was under massive threat. It was under absolutely immense threat because there was no hint that anyone was going to try and preserve the cobbles. You know, it was only 8 years after Jacques Godet called Albert Bouvet into his office and got him to basically rejig the entire route, putting in all the sections that we know, you know, around Valenciennes, particularly the Orenburg Trench. So it was under huge threat. And like, one thing I write in the book is that at the time when Leth did his film, he didn't, you know, that race could have, you know, quite easily ceased to exist a few years after, you know.
So should people read the book first and see the film, or see the film and then read the book?
My advice would be see the film and then read the book. Alternatively, if you can't get to the film, if you can't get to a screening, you know, screen the film, we're showing various screenings where you can come along and watch the film and then get a copy of the book, which I'll sign. But if you can't do that, the other alternative is you can get a DVD, and the best one is through the Danish Film Institute, or as final recourse there is a YouTube version, but the quality of the visuals is nowhere near as good.
So that was William Fotheringham there. His new book, Sunday in Hell, is out now, and he was looking back at the 76 Paris-Roubaix. And what makes Paris-Roubaix such a special race, as it is? Who's going to win this Sunday, chaps?
Roger de Vlaeminck.
Roger de Vlaeminck's going to win on Sunday.
Yeah, he's gonna finally claim that fifth cobblestone. Now, I wish Roger de Vlaeminck was still racing. Unfortunately, we only see him competing these days in things like the World Wife Carrying Championship, not Paris-Roubaix. But
No, not quite Paris-Roubaix, is it, Lionel?
Well, I mean, this is taking speculation to ridiculous lengths. You know, for de Vlaeminck, maybe, I mean, it is so difficult to say, isn't it? That's the thing. I mean, anything I say now will be disproved by events. And if I somehow pick the winner, you know, I'm doing so.
It'll just be luck,
more or less. Yeah, but I do think that, you know, all the riders you mentioned there. I mean, I think that the fact that that Team EF Education First have got Langeveld and Van Mark, you know, that that adds to their strength. I mean, Sky, Moscon, Luke Rowe, I mean, again, he was riding very well before his disqualification. Difficult to say how he will go over the, you know, the additional distance, but, you know, has done well in the past. So it's going to come down to it's the numbers game and who plays it the smartest out of, you know, and weighs up the relative strength of their riders best on the day. I mean, that's kind of how it goes, isn't it? The team has to kind of commit, right, this is, you know, for example, if Daniel Oss went up the road at some point, you know, Bora would have to say, well, is this what we're going to do, or are we going to, try and do something with Peter Sagan? I mean, that's how these Paris-Roubaix particularly plays out. The decisions aren't made on the week before or even in the team meeting. It's out on the road when stuff is happening.
Daniel Oss would be a good winner.
He's
Daniel
the Oss sort of rider that could winner, you could imagine him just riding away and everyone doing the equivalent of letting Terpstra go up the road and then realising when it's just too late. I mean, that was the thing with Terpstra. It was too late immediately, and they probably realised it immediately, but no one was able to react at that point, because whoever was going to react would have lost the race for themselves, and so there was no incentive for them to make that move. And Paris-Roubaix is very similar in that sense, and we've seen it so many times before. Somebody just puts in an effort coming off the cobbles that, you know, when everyone is trying to take a breather. And so it's all about the positioning going into each cobbled section, how they get over that cobbled section, and you can actually, as the race unfolds, you can see the tells on different riders of who is weakening as the cobbled sections go on, and that's what I find sort of fascinating about the whole race, really, is, you know, somebody can look absolutely amazing and then two sections later they're just not holding the wheel, and then the doors open and then that's their race gone. So yeah, why not somebody go for a long one that we're not expecting? Or maybe it'll come down to eight riders in the velodrome, who knows?
The bookies, Napalm, who do speculation, they've got Peter Sagan as favourite, which is ridiculous. All of them have got Sagan as favourite. Then, well, we know how that works. But
he's his favourite for every race, isn't he?
My tip would be Arnaud Démare.
That is a very good shout.
I think he's been riding really well all spring. He's not particularly well suited to Flanders, says that himself. But FDJ did a big sort of 2 or 3 day stint up in Roubaix at the start of the year. They went over the cobbles when it was very muddy, and then they did some sessions in the Velo Bowl, in the Roubaix Velo Bowl. They did some long sessions just working on riding at a really high tempo, sort of simulating the finale in Paris-Roubaix. And I think he's a good bet. Obviously a huge, hugely important race for that team as well, a race that Marc Madiot won. How many times did he win it? Twice. And they won it in way back in 1997 with Fred Gaydon, who I think is the last Frenchman.
He is the last French winner, yeah. Yeah, radical stuff though from Groupama to actually practice their cycling before the race. That's incredible stuff.
I just hope Tony Martin doesn't knock him off at some point. But no, that is a good shout. They've looked good as a team as well, and you know, perhaps that intervention by Tony Martin actually hampered their game plan on Sunday as well. Another guy who was up there was Christophe. I thought Christophe rode pretty well at the weekend, and in theory could, you know, has a good Paris-Roubaix in him, and if he can get to the finish in a group with Démare, could be a shootout between the pair of them. A guy who's not riding, but Quickstep, Bob Jungels, does he have a good Paris-Roubaix in him at some point?
He won the junior Paris-Roubaix, I think I'm right in saying. But,
well, there you go.
He's very much focusing on other things these days, isn't he?
I mean, Peter Sagan won junior Paris-Roubaix as well, didn't he? So,
mind you, so did Yaroslav Popovich.
Peter Sagan must have won the under 23 because he didn't win the junior, but Mads Pedersen won the junior Paris-Roubaix, as did Jasper Stuyven, as did your man Florian Seneschal, Daniel. So
voila.
Before we go, Rich, why don't we just hear a little clip from your Friends of the Podcast special last year, made with Matt Heyman, who had won the 2016 edition, having come off the back of an injury, crashed at Het Nieuwsblad, and then trained solo in his garage, and came back and won Paris-Roubaix.
sometimes when I look at the young guys and see that they've got 10, 12 years, I'm a bit jealous of that. That you're going to be lining up at these big races, rolling into that amphitheatre at Brugge to start Flanders. You know, it's spine tingling, rolling down the start of in Compiègne and heading off on a Roubaix and getting to the Velodrome there. You know, that's just, it's what it's all about. That's why you do it. That's why you train for months in the winter.
Slightly downhill at this point, and Heyman has clipped onto the back. And Tom Bonan is sitting in second position.
If you'd like to hear the rest of that episode, Richard talking to Matt Heyman, talking through how he won Paris-Roubaix while watching footage of the race. Fascinating.
Well, we watched the race, yeah. We watched the final hour.
Yeah, it was a great idea, that.
You only saying that because it was your idea.
Yeah, that's fine. You executed it brilliantly, Rich. But if anyone wants to listen to that, brilliant. It's part of our 2017 Friends of the Podcast program. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. It's £10 to listen to all of last year's content, and we are rolling out this year's Friends of the Podcast episodes on a more or less monthly basis. There'll be a few specials coming up as we get to the Grand Tour season as well. Bonuses, I should say.
Well, we've got one coming up on Liège-Bastogne-Liège as well, don't we? We've just released one called the Flanders Cycling School, which follows some of the young riders trying to make it as a pro in Belgium and living in a house belonging to Tim Harris and Jocelyn Ryan in East Flanders. We had a message from a listener who suggested that we make that episode available free to young riders, and so that's what we're doing. It's a great idea. If you are a junior or an under 23 rider anywhere in the world, then please email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and we will give you free access to that episode, the Flanders Cycling Factory, which is also available to friends of the podcast. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up. Can I just correct something that I said about Peter Sagan? He actually finished second in the junior Paris-Roubaix in 2008 to Andy Fenn, the British rider who rides for Aqua Blue now.
And Rich, Bob Youngles won the under-23 Paris-Roubaix, not the junior Paris-Roubaix, and he won it by about 3 minutes.
Should we wrap things up there, chaps? I'm not sure I got your tip, but we got Daniel's tip for Paris-Roubaix. Lionel, just say a name. Just say a name.
I'm going to say then, seeing as they're going well and they had a good result with Mads Pedersen, I'm going to say Jasper Stuyven.
Okay, I'll go for Daniel Oss. There we are, left field. Okay, that's all for this week. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. Become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Not only do you get access to exclusive feature-length documentary-style episodes, you help us provide free daily coverage of all three Grand Tours. This episode was edited and produced by Will Jones.